All right, we're going to continue with the larger and shorter catechisms, what man ought to believe concerning God. The final section dealing with various aspects of Christ's exaltation in question 56 of the larger catechism. Question 56, how is Christ to be exalted in his coming again to judge the world? Answer. Christ is to be exalted in his coming again to judge the world in that he, who was unjustly judged and condemned by wicked men, shall come again at the last day in great power and in the full manifestation of his own glory and of his Father's with all his holy angels, with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, to judge the world in righteousness. This last section is concerned with the idea of Christ coming again in judgment. It may not be entirely apparent, even with respect to the answer, why this is included in his exaltation. But if we consider his coming again and understand that this is predicated upon him in the character of mediator, the coming again is second coming, is the definitive mark of his exaltation. That is, at that time, his right to rule, his right to engage all of creation will be vindicated in a way that, frankly, is unprecedented. As we're going to see, one of the things that we can say is it's going to be vindicated in a way that is highly visible and perceptible to the entire creation. It's going to be apparent that he, in fact, is exercising this judgment in his character, his official character as mediator. And that indicates a degree of exaltation that is, in fact, equal with God. So that although essentially, as he is God, essentially, substantially God, there is no exaltation. But in his character as mediator, this assumed humanity is in fact being exalted by reason of this hypostatic union. And in this coming again to judgment, his humanity is being exalted in this union to a certain equality with his divinity. It's being placed on a par with his divinity by being given this universal judgment that we're going to see. So we need to talk about some of the circumstances surrounding his coming in judgment. We should be clear about that. We need to look at least briefly at the one who is judge, Christ, and what that entails and what that means. We're going to also look at who and what is to be judged. You know, unto whom does this judgment pertain? Is this a partial judgment, or is this much fuller, broader? So that's another aspect that we have to look at. Finally, we're going to look at the properties of the judgment and then the ends of the judgment. We need to look at what we can say about this judgment in terms of its properties. but also the teleos, the end. Why is it that there is a judgment? What's the point of all of that? And so these things are all related to his judging. Some of them are implied or even more explicitly held forth in the answer to our question. But all of them pertain to his judging at his second coming. Now, as we consider this, his coming again to judgment, we need to understand that for individuals, much of what we're going to be talking about when we talk about his coming again to judgment, much of this is going to become apparent to individuals at the time of their death. But we're not talking about that. We're going to come back to that, but we're not talking about that. We're looking for something more than that, and I'll explain why as we get into it in more detail. But just because, to a certain extent, this coming again unto judgment is, from our perspective, something which is in the remote future. It's not, contrary to the premillennialists and amillennialists, it's not going to happen today or tomorrow in the terms that we're talking about here. But the reality of it will inform and color what happens to every person at the time of their death. Right, so, Judgment Day is, in that respect, casting a long shadow in, you know, not only to us, but to everyone who's gone before us. You know, from the time of the very first man, Judgment Day was casting a long shadow. Adam and Eve, when they're told that if they eat in the day they eat of that tree, they will surely die. What makes that such a threatening judgment is that Judgment Day casts this long shadow that affects them as individuals. Right? They're going to be taken up as individuals, but Judgment Day will be a confirmation of all of these individual judgments issued at the times of the deaths of various people. So, we need to keep in mind that it is part of his exaltation, although I'm not going to be emphasizing that at every point. I want to look more at the nature of the judgment, the second coming, what's going to be involved. It's important that in the back of your mind you remember this. This represents the highest point of his exaltation. And the reason for that is Judgment Day, as we'll see, marks the end of time as we know it. It puts a stop to that. And so whatever changes await human nature beyond time, these are all things that are going to... The way things change and the way we're impacted, there's some shift that we really don't understand. But it appears to be, from the descriptions of the difference between time and eternity, it appears to be not simply quantitative, but qualitative. that there is some kind of a change, right? And we're not, the purpose of getting into this question is not to examine what qualitatively what that change is going to mean, so much as point out that there is this change, and that's a more important thing for us to remember with respect to this question. Right. So, question one. What is the manner and circumstances of Christ's coming in judgment? And the answer, as I've already alluded to, is though he is now known by the judgments he executes, he makes himself known through these judgments. If we look at Psalm 9, verse 16.
Psalm 9, verse 16. The Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. Selah.
Yeah, the Lord is known by the judgment the judgments he executes. And we can say that providentially, the things that come to pass, God is making himself known in these ways. Christ, who is over the course of providence, he himself is made known by these judgments, and in a certain respect. And we can add to that that though the eternal state of all men is fixed at their death, when a particular judgment is passed on them by Christ,
Hebrews 9:27. And as it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this the judgment.
The fact is this, these present acts of judgment are done without the external and visible marks of glory in his human nature with which he shall appear in the end of time. Look at Acts 1:11.
Acts 1:11. Which also said, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? The same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye have seen him go into heaven."
So the point is this. This judgment is going to be such that the external and visible marks of glory will be visible. Christ's external and visible marks of glory will be visible in and through his assumed humanity. We don't see that. It's not made visible in the judgments he's executing now against the wicked or the righteous, or the fixing of the eternal state of men at their death. Right? We don't see that. Right? I mean, when someone dies, all we see is a dead body. We don't see the judgment affixed to that body, like we will see. Like all men will behold on Judgment Day. And they'll behold that judgment as the judgment of the one who is sent to judge the world. And that is Christ. And all judgment's been given unto him. We're going to come back to that. But that's important. Okay, he's exercising on Judgment Day. He's going to be exercising a judgment that's going to be palpable because it will be visible to all of us. We're going to hear it. We're going to see it. We're going to see, in fact, some men experience the wrath of God while others experience the grace of God. We're going to have a vision of this unlike anything that we could comprehend now. But the important thing is that this is going to be accomplished in such a way that it will clearly demonstrate to us that the person who has assumed this true humanity is the eternal Son of God. Right. There's not going to be this sort of spiritual sense what have you, it's going to be visible, palpable. It's going to be done in such a way that these external and visible marks of glory that pertain to Christ and his true humanity are going to be on display for all to see. Okay, we're going to see that God has exalted him in this true humanity to the point of exercising judgment, a judgment that's going to be visible for all of the creation. Now this judgment, this judgment is called the last day. And the reason is, it's going to mark the transition from the common measure of duration that we call time to another, which by reason of its having no end, is called eternity. And as I say, precisely what this is, what this shift is, we don't know. We don't have a clear view in Scripture of the difference. There are indications, there are certain analogies that we can probably draw, but there's something, it's not just that it goes on forever. That would be quantity. But there's also a qualitative difference. And we might even ask whether or not it would be proper to characterize it as duration. Duration, at least from our point of view, implies a certain wearing out. You know, there's some idea of something, you know, what's the duration of the warranty? What's the duration of this or that thing? We start to talk in those terms, and we're really talking about when something sort of peters out and comes to an end. Right? That's how much can you endure? And yet, there's something about eternity that even for those who are in hell, they're going to be made to endure forever. And so, is this really a duration in the sense that we think of it? Well, those are all questions for another time and another topic. It's called the last day. I want to look at John 11:24 and 12:48.
John 11, verse 24. Martha said to him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day.
John 12, verse 48. He that rejected me and receiveth not my words, hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day.
Yeah, so there's a sense that the last day, you know, if we, in terms of the Bible, we live in the last days, or there's the latter days, the idea that even the last days are the latter days of the last days, but Judgment Day is the last day. Right? It's the day before eternity. So it's a demarcation. It's a line drawn in time. And it's saying that when we hit this point in time, everything that we know about time vanishes away, and what we call eternity will begin. That forever and ever, right? There's no end. It's going to be without end. There will be in eternity. There will be an endurance of sorts. You know, nobody is going to vanish away. We don't believe in annihilation, for example. Right? Everyone is going to be there. Everyone will, in fact, go on into eternity. Now, of course, this is why what we're talking about is so serious. Now, when we talk about Judgment Day, it's such a serious thing because at Judgment Day, all of the things that we look at in time, we measure our lives, we measure everything we do in terms of time. And those measurements give us opportunities for ups and downs, for activity and inactivity. It allows for the ebb and flow of life that we're used to. But eternity doesn't seem to have that kind of ebb and flow. The highs and the lows, if you will. Eternity is characterized by an entirely different course, and we are going to bear an entirely different relation to that course. So the last day is an important point. Just from the point of view of dividing time from eternity. Just like in Genesis, there was a beginning. Right? There was a beginning of time, there's an end of time. Judgment Day is telling us, as much as creation told us that there's a beginning, Judgment Day is telling us there's an end of this thing that we call time. Right? And with it, a dissolution of a kind of relation we bear to eternity and to things which are eternal, like God. Now, without belaboring that anymore, the manner and circumstances of Christ coming in judgment should be first of all, and these are really all very important things to consider. First, in the observation of the whole of the assembled world, being seen by the eyes of all who are upon the earth in that day. Revelation 1, 7. So every eye is going to see him. And that, if we understand what's going on, that really includes everyone. As we're going to see, even the dead are raised for this event. Okay, so nothing is going to stand between all of the creation and this observation.
Do you think it'll all take place at one spot, or is it all over the earth, where in all the corners of the earth the people see Christ, or is it, you'll kind of gather them into one specific spot where they can all stand before him and see him, or is it clear?
I don't know that we're told that. I think what we're told, and this is clear, that everyone is going to see. So there aren't going to be any bad seats for Judgment Day, and everybody's going to be in a seat where they can see what's going on, or more likely standing in a position where they can observe the entire thing unfold.
And the elect will observe from a different standpoint, correct? Because the elect will see the judgment on the wicked, correct?
When we get to that point in Judgment Day, yes, the elect are going to observe, but when we're just talking about his coming again, every eye is going to see him in his coming again. Nobody's going to be blind to this. Nobody's going to be looking in some other direction. Right? It's not going to be like other events in life. You know, sometimes somebody will say to you, hey, did you see that? And you have to say, no, I missed that. That's not going to happen on Judgment Day. Nobody's going to have to tell you. Everybody is going to know what it is as it unfolds. So every eye is going to see. And in order for that to occur, everybody who's ever lived is going to be raised to observe, to this observation. Whether it's just by virtue of vantage point, he'll be descending as he ascended. We just don't know a whole lot about how, or the mechanism, how everyone is going to see, but we're told everyone will see. And seeing that, there's not going to be anyone who's sitting around saying, "What am I looking at?" You know, sometimes you see things and you don't know what they are. This is going to be pretty apparent. It's going to captivate and capture the attention of everyone, and that's what it's designed to do. Like, the point is, this is, everyone is going to see this occur. Right. The second aspect of the manner and circumstance of his coming in judgment is that it will be suddenly and surprisingly. And it's at a time when the whole world is, as it were, sleeping in its deepest security. Look at Matthew 24:37.
Matthew 24:37. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be.
Okay, as the days of Noah were. Well, how were the days of Noah? Men were eating, drinking, giving in marriage. They were going about their daily routines, but they were secure. They were not looking for it.
How does the millennium play into this? Because after the millennium, there's going to be a short falling away. Does that mean that it's going to be probably the worst the church has ever fared on earth? Where this whole, the whole world thinks it has, it's been secure and it's evil.
There's going to be a certain security toward the end of the millennium that will characterize everyone. And a lot of people are going to be taken off guard for this. So they're not going to miss it. Point is, they're not going to be expecting it. You know, after the millennial period, people are going to be... And this is always a problem. People become complacent. And after 1,000 years or whatever of relatively high standards of both religion and the effects of religion, true religion, people are going to be in a much more complacent state. You know, if you haven't really kept up, if you started to slide, you started to back off a little bit, you're going to be in trouble, because it's going to be sudden. It's going to be at a time that you think not, right? So it behooves men to be on guard against the coming of that day. For example, Paul says so in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 2.
1 Thessalonians 5:2, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night.
Yeah, the day comes, that is judgment day, as a thief in the night. If you had known, you would have paid attention, right? If you knew he was coming. But the point is, people are going to forget about it. They're going to be complacent. They're really going to be people who are so comfortable, so secure, that they're not going to be thinking about it. It's going to be the last thing on the minds of most people. And it's going to be at such a time as that. The third thing is that the Christ coming in judgment will be seasonably. That is, it's going to happen at the very precise point and period of time fixed in the eternal counsels of heaven, being the exact moment set from eternity. 2 Peter 3:9-10.
2 Peter 3, verses 9 and 10. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering toward usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up.
So, again, when is he coming? There's a fixed day. Jesus refers to that day and that hour knoweth no man, not even the Son of Man, but my Father who is in heaven. There's a day set. It's not going to come sooner, it's not going to come later.
So Christ, that's to his humanity, didn't know the date.
No, he had disavowed divine prerogative, didn't have access to that information at that time. He'd set aside that knowledge. And fourth, his coming in judgment will be terribly, in such a manner that the ungodly will be seized with terror and tremble at his appearing. Revelation 6, 14 to 17.
Revelation 6, verses 14 through 17. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places, and the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. And he said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand?
Right, and when we're talking about and using these different examples of judgment, the judgment to come, every judgment throughout history, and what makes each judgment terrible, what makes it a frightful thing, is precisely this, that it is looking forward to judgment day. Right? It is shaking people out of, or should be shaking people out of their carnal security. For the wicked, for the ungodly, judgment's going to come suddenly and fearfully, terribly. Right? Judgment day is going to be like that. I mean, a lot of people are going to be caught unaware. They're going to be looking for some escape, but there's not going to be any escape. You know, this is going to be the kind of thing where you're caught. You're caught red-handed. You're caught, and you know you're caught. And you know there's no evading. You know that there's nowhere to hide. There's no way to get around it. That's a terrible, terrible thing. They're just not going to be able to escape. Right, the fifth thing is, it's going to, Christ coming in judgment will be gloriously. And the reason is, men are going to behold him in his exalted glory as mediator. That's what's going to make it glorious. Look at Mark 13:26 and Luke 9:26.
Mark 13, verse 26. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory.
Luke 9, verse 26. For whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he shall come in his own glory, and in his Father's, and of the holy angels.
Right. So, men, beside the suddenness, beside the fact that it's going to be observed by everyone, the terribleness of it, the other aspect is, and we can't leave this out, he's going to appear in this great power in glory. Right? The glory of the Father is going to be resting upon him. The glory of the exalted mediator is going to characterize Christ in the second coming. It's going to be a very, very definitive moment in which not only will there be an accounting given, will men know that they've been caught by the wicked, but it's going to be the kind of event that all eyes that see him are going to see him in glory. They're going to recognize that the mediator is exalted and that he has been given these prerogatives of divinity by a donation. And this is not the second coming, just like all of the other things we're talking about with regard to Christ the mediator. This is not the action of God essentially considered. This is the acting of the eternal Son of God incarnate. It is, in fact, the representing the complete exaltation of Christ as to his humanity. Now, in evidence of this, we should consider that this coming shall be in that glory that characterized his transfiguration. Look at Matthew 17:2.
Matthew 17:2. And was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was as white as the light.
At the Mount of Transfiguration, what the apostles were allowed to see, they were given a vision of his divine person shining forth through this humanity. And in this exaltation, he takes up again his divine prerogatives, right, so that he is in a position to exercise all of his prerogatives through this assumed humanity. This is part of his exaltation. And so, that glowing, glistening, radiant vision that the apostles have on the Mount of Transfiguration, this is an indication of the appearance that Christ is going to have in his coming again.
So everything he laid aside during his humiliation, he will take to himself again during his exaltation.
He's taking it to himself.
Well, he already has it right now, yeah. But it's not visible to us, correct?
In the second coming, we're going to see that divinity on display in his true humanity. We didn't see it in his first coming. His humiliation, it was shielded, it was veiled. We're going to see all of that glowing and breaking forth. So that's going to be part of why we say it's glorious. He's going to be shining. Now, if we look at the various accounts in the Bible of the angels, there are a number of reasons to think from the accounts. The angels are not just spirit beings, but they're light, they're shining, they're glistening, they're like the stars in the firmament.
I was going to ask you about that. Is there any correlation between the angels and the stars, or is that kind of going too far? In Job, doesn't it say the morning stars shouted for glory?
Yeah, we. I'm not sure that there's enough information on that, but to understand that the angels are, in some sense, involved in every aspect of providence, then I think we can say that the angels are, in some respect, they're involved in all that we see around us, including the stars and the sky. You know, there's no, in other words, there's nothing, the things that we describe scientifically, you know, like gravity and things like that, this is angels pushing things down, pulling things up, right? Which is, from the point of view of the providence of God, it's no harder a thing to have a ball fall to the ground as have an axe head float in the water. Right? But God has established certain regularities in the order of providence that we can depend on so that we can sort of navigate through this world. But from the point of view of his absolute power and the involvement of the angels, there really isn't any difference between one and the other. You know, it's no more difficult, you know, for God to make the sun move backward than to make it move forward. The angels. I mean, the psalmist talks about the angels are pulling the sun through the sky, if you will. Right? So they're somehow involved. The ministry of angels is involved in this orderliness that we observe, that God has sent them forth to do and to be these kinds of things.
Didn't you say one time that Luther said that like the angels are even moving your
fingers? Yeah, Luther, I think it may have been in his comments on Ezekiel, that talks about the angels, when you open and close your hands, the angels are making your fingers open and close. They're that intimately involved. So are they connected to the stars? Well, if they're that connected to the way everything moves and the stars are moving in the heavens, then yes, the angels are in some respect connected to the stars. Right. So beside this glorious, glimmering, shining presence that will be Christ at his second coming, it's going to be accompanied with the most fearful convulsions of nature as fire breaks out before him, consuming all the corrupted dross. Look at Psalm 50, verse 3, and Daniel 7, verses 9 and 10.
Psalm 50, verse 3, our God shall come and shall not keep silence. A fire shall devour before him, and it shall be very tempestuous round about him.
Daniel 7, 9 and 10. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened.
All right, so if we consider this for a moment, this shining forth of his divinity through his true humanity. You know, if you're reconciled to God, that's not a threat. But if you're not reconciled to God, that's like fire coming out of him. It's going to burn up everything that's been corrupted by sin. Right? Everything that is unreconciled, that needs to have some kind of reconciliation, all of that is going to be consumed by the brightness of his coming. And he's going to consume that. Additionally, he's going to be attended with a retinue of innumerable angels. I look at Matthew 16, 27.
Matthew 16, verse 27. For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works.
And so, if he is going to be like the day star arising, like the sun in its fullness alighting upon the earth, you know, in his descent, in his coming again, these angels around him are going to be like the stars of heaven. They're just going to be the brightest glistening light surrounded by even more light, somehow augmenting that light. Nobody's going to miss this. There's not any place on earth where you can be. There's not even any state on earth in which you can be, dead or alive, where you're going to miss this. Right? Interestingly, I think, is this. He's going to be seated upon a throne that is high and lifted up, and before him shall appear all men and devils to receive judgment. Matthew 25, 31 and 32, as well as Revelation 20, 11 and 12.
Matthew 25, verses 31 and 32. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats.
Revelation 20, 11 and 12. And I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were open, and another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works.
So again, significantly, interestingly, he's not just appearing in this brightness, but he's appearing enthroned. That is, it will be clear that he, in the character of mediator, has been enthroned, that he has been invested with all of the prerogatives of that royal divinity, and that all of this has been given him, and that all men, in fact, owe him homage, respect, obedience. Right? He's going to appear, in other words, in the character of the rightful monarch of men. You're not going to miss this point. Not only are you not going to miss his second coming, you're not going to miss the point of it all. Right? This is all part of it. And then we can say, shall he appear in great power? Matthew 24:30.
Matthew 24:30. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory.
Yeah, great power, great glory. Now, that's the manner and the circumstances in which Christ is going to come again. And that's all very important. But now let's talk briefly about who is the one who will judge. Question two, who is the one who will judge? And let's consider for a moment that the very one who is coming in this way to judge is even the one who was unjustly judged and condemned by wicked men. When he was here on earth during the time of his humiliation, wicked men judged him unjustly, condemned him without cause, delivered him up to be crucified without any reason, without any genuine pretext. Right? Think of that, the contrast here. Look at Acts 3:14-15.
Acts 3:14-15. But you deny the Holy One and the just, and desire the murderer to be granted unto you, and kill the Prince of Life, whom God hath raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses.
Yeah, the judgment of the world, in other words, with regard to Christ, is exactly the opposite of what is true and real. I mean, that's how corrupt mankind is. When Christ comes into the world the first time, men judge him guilty, who is guiltless. They condemn the most innocent of men. Right? They have no misgivings about turning him over to be crucified, which is, we've talked about this in the past, quite possibly the most inhuman, barbaric method of execution ever devised. And all of this without any genuine pretext. There's no real legal reason for this. There's no justice. None. And there's certainly no mercy. Now this very one, the apostle makes clear, this very one, Jesus Christ, is ordained the judge of the world. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10.
2 Corinthians 5, verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad.
And in this, he's ordained the judge of the world, and the reason, there are actually several reasons, I think, that we can trace out as to why he is the one who is, in fact, ordained judge of the world. The first is this judgment is to be acted visibly for men. The judgment that is to be acted visibly for men shall be judged, the whole process with them shall be for the things done in the body. Okay, so this isn't just an invisible or a not so obvious judgment. But this judgment that we're talking about is for things that men have done in the body. Look at Romans 2:6.
Romans 2, verse 6. Who will render to every man according to his deeds?
He's going to render to every man according to his deeds, the things he's done in the body. Right? So the judgment needs to be visible. The deeds were visible. Now, Christ is, in fact, God incarnate, God manifest in the flesh. There's going to be a clear visibility to his enacting. Right. Second, only Christ is qualified for this office because, really, a couple reasons. First, of the great dignity and excellency of his person, being the eternal Son of God incarnate. Hebrews 1, 5.
Hebrews 1, verse 5. For unto which of the angels said he at any time, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son.
Yeah, so here he's been given this office of judge, which would surpass the capacity of any man or angel. This is something that can be accomplished only by one who is himself God. And yet, as I said, the point of this is the judgment will be visible. And so it is God incarnate. But he's the eternal Son of God incarnate. And there's a dignity, an excellency of the person. There's not going to be any gainsaying. This is not a judgment that's going to be executed by someone who doesn't really know, someone who doesn't have a command of the facts, someone who couldn't possibly understand. This is going to be executed by one who is supremely qualified because he is the eternal Son of God, but more so, he's the eternal Son of God incarnate. And second, of the great difficulty of the work of judging aright, for he discerns the thoughts of the heart.
Psalm 44, verse 21. Shall not God search the south, for he knoweth the secrets of the heart.
Again, any lesser person would not be in a position to know what Christ knows. know, there's not going to be anything hidden. You're not going to be able to hide anything, nor are you going to be able to plead any extenuating circumstance of which he wouldn't already be aware. Right, so the very fact that judging this judgment is going to be such a difficult thing, such a troublesome thing, that tells us that he actually, by virtue of who he is, he's the only one who's really in a position, who's in a way that they can, that he could execute this judgment aright. Right? There's not going to be any mistakes here. We're not going to have a mistrial. Right? There's not going to be any evidence that's going to be kept back. It's just simply not going to be any point at which there's going to be a discrepancy between the truth and the judgment. You know, everything needed, all the information needed, Christ has. Third, Christ alone, we're told, has been constituted judge of the world as a reward of his death and bloody sufferings. Philippians 2:8-10.
Philippians 2:8-10. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth.
So this is the reward of his humiliation. It's the culmination of his exaltation. But it's a reward of his humiliation. So, he's in the best position to offer the judgment of God in a manner that we can see and understand and with which we will not be able to dispute. Because he's going to offer this judgment in the character of the mediator, the God-man. He's going to offer it as God incarnate, you know, having great familiarity with us, because he's assumed our true humanity. He's lived the life of a man. All right, question three. Who and what shall be judged? The first is, I think, pretty clear, should be clear, that there is none that shall escape this judgment seat of Christ. All must appear before it. Again, 2 Corinthians 5:10.
2 Corinthians 5:10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter who you are, what you are. There's not going to be any excuse, right? No one's going to be excused from Judgment Day. Nobody is going to be left out. Anyone who's ever lived is going to be taken into this. Doesn't matter. Men of all conditions, young and old, rich and poor, princes and peasants, believers and unbelievers, no one, not one, is going to be excused. There's just no way out of this. Judgment Day is going to come, and all men will participate. 2 Timothy 4:1.
2 Timothy 4:1. I charge thee therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, living or dead. Right? No one is going to be excused. There's not going to be any hiding. The people have come up with all kinds of ways to try to convince themselves they're going to get around this somehow. But the Bible is clear. And although I'm not going to belabor this point, it is important, again, that we remember this judgment is real and it's going to affect everyone. Everyone's going to come to it. Okay, there's no way around it. It's at that last day. There's that line of demarcation between time and eternity. And you're going to run into it. Right? Now, the things that are going to be judged are, I think, reducible to three headings. The first is, we know all the works which men do will come into judgment, whether they're good or evil. I'll look at Ecclesiastes 12:14.
Ecclesiastes 12, verse 14. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil.
Yeah, notice, I like this verse in Ecclesiastes because it's very, very clear. God is going to bring every work. Again, there's not going to be some things which come into judgment and some things which don't. Now, why is that important that we emphasize this? I think because there are a lot of people who don't understand that everything you do, can be judged either good or evil. A lot of people who say, well, that wasn't a sin, that was a mistake. No. Everything you do, everything is going to come into this judgment. Some things are done more high-handedly, with more hostility, open hostility, and rejection of God. There are, and we've talked about this, there are extenuating circumstances. There are aggravating circumstances. You know, some things are more sinful by reason of their several connections than others. But every work, that's everything you do, is going to come into judgment. Doesn't really matter what you think. You know, oh, I didn't mean that. That's what you said. But everything you do is going to come to judgment. You're not going to escape that. You're not going to be able to plead that somehow a certain category of things you do fall outside of the judgment of God. Right? Nothing is like that. The second kind of things that are to be judged are all of men's words shall also be brought before the tribunal of Christ, whether words have been employed for the glory of God and the edification of one another, or for some other base purpose. Matthew 12:36.
Matthew 12:36. But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment.
Yeah, and if for every idle word you're going to give an account, how much more for the non-idle words? That is, the things that you said and you meant it. Right? There's not going to be any word. There's not any place where you're going to be able to go verbally and say, this was neutral. Right? This doesn't really fall under the judgment of God. Everything you do, everything you say, God's going to bring everything to judgment. He's going to shine the light of His truth on all of this and make an open display. You're going to know whether or not this was right or wrong. probably already do know. But Judgment Day is going to nail that down. There's not going to be any wiggle room, right? You're not going to be able to say, well, if you take it this way, or I didn't mean to say that that way. God already knows. And so all of this is going to come to judgment. Okay, third, the very thoughts and intents of the heart shall be brought to judgment. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 5.
1 Corinthians 4, 5. Therefore judge nothing before the time, until the Lord come, who both will bring to light the hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsels of the heart. And then shall every man have praise of God.
And so he's going to bring to light things that we couldn't even begin to judge. We're not in a position. God is. All the thoughts, all the intents of the heart, every deep, dark secret, everything that you think. You know, again, it's not neutral. There's not a neutral ground. There's not some sort of black box within which you can say this or that or think this or that, and it's going to be viewed as just an innocent expression or a non-harmful thought. I mean, after all, Jesus says that it's out of the heart that all these sins, the murder, adultery, fornication, blasphemy, and all of these things flow out of the heart. God's going to be looking at that. This stuff is coming up for judgment. Right? So everyone is going to be judged, and they're going to be judged in terms of everything they think, everything they say, everything they do. In other words, there's nothing it's going to be left out. That's important, because as we're going to see, the fact that God knows all of this with a perfect knowledge, an infallible knowledge, that assures us his judgments are going to be righteous. His sentence is going to be passed without any possibility of appeal, right? We'll come back to that, but it's not going to happen. You're not going to be able to bring additional evidence and have the judge change his mind. All of the evidence is there. Thought, word, and deed. All right, question four. What should be the properties of this judgment? The properties of this judgment are several. First of all, this judgment is going to be a universal judgment. One which shall arraign those who lived under the law, under the gospel, and even those who, having no law, were a law unto themselves. Romans 2:12.
Romans 2:12. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law.
Yeah, there's not any category, right, of people who are going to avoid this judgment day. Doesn't really matter. Were you under the law? Were you under the gospel? Were you under neither? The people who, and there have been a number of them, I think that if you were not born under the law or under the light of the gospel, somehow you're just not going to come into judgment. Not true. Right? You're going to come into judgment. You're not in a state of primitive innocence. In order to effect this judgment, as I alluded to earlier, the bowels of the earth, the depth of the sea, all the elements shall give up their dead so that none may escape. Revelation 20, verse 13.
Revelation 20, 13. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works.
What a horrible thing. You're not going to be able to hide. Right? It's universal. You're not going to belong to some category of people who somehow don't get judged. So wherever you are, living or dead, whoever you are, rich or poor, prince, peasant, believer or unbeliever, right? Doesn't really matter. This judgment is going to be universal. It's going to apply to all men. It's important to recognize that those who don't know the gospel will be held to, in some sense, a lesser account. Those who don't have the law, to a certain extent, will be held to a lesser account. It doesn't mean they're not coming into judgment. No, judgment is worse. It's better that you've never heard the truth if you're not going to believe it than to hear the truth and not believe it. When you're confronted with the truth, to reject the truth is already to confess yourself guilty in these respects. Right, second, it's going to be an awful day of judgment wherein sinners and devils shall not stand. Jude 6.
Jude, verse 6. And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, unto the judgment of that great, of the great day.
Yeah, unto the judgment of the great day. It's an awful thing. There's going to be a dreadful catastrophe of the world which shall fill men's hearts with the horror and fear as the very bands of nature are torn asunder, judgment day. Matthew 24, verse 29.
Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken.
Yeah, it's going to be a time of catastrophe. Right? The elements are going to melt away and burn with fire. You're not going to have any place to hide, no place to stand. If you're an enemy of God, if you rejected Christ, this is just all going to be horror after horror, terror after terror, mounting greater and greater as judgment day unfolds. In fact, the very manner of his coming is designed to strike fear in the hearts of his enemies as the shout of an army gathered for battle. 1 Thessalonians 4:16-17.
1 Thessalonians 4:16-17. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord.
Yeah, this voice, this trumpet, the great shout, the great trumpet sound, that's a language that should make you think of an army advancing. You know, they're blowing their trumpets like we see in the Old Testament. They're shouting for victory as they gain the mastery over the enemy. This is all language designed to strike fear in the hearts of the enemies of God and his people. It's going to be a terrible, horrible day for unbelievers. They're just simply not going to escape. He's advancing on them with purpose. He's advancing on them in a way that is comprehensive. It's a comprehensive, full frontal attack. And nobody's going to evade it. Nobody's going to escape. Third, this judgment will be exact and critical, for the searcher of the heart will expose all secrets and bring everything to light that is hidden. Romans 2:16.
Romans 2, verse 16. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel.
Yeah, the secrets of men. Again, it's going to be terrible. There are things that men do that they think will never come to light. In fact, generally speaking, men sin because they have the sense that it's secret. That there are a lot of things that people will do privately that they wouldn't do publicly. On Judgment Day, all those secrets are going to come to light. None of this, you're going to find, was really done without observation. God saw it in your conscience. Your conscience is going to be played back like a voice recorder or like a life recorder. And you're going to bear witness against yourself for all these things. All the acts of commission in youth and age, whether gross sensuality or any other excess, all these things are going to be judged. 1 Peter 4:4-5.
1 Peter 4:4-5. Wherein they think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. Who shall give account to him that is ready to judge the quick and the dead?
Yeah, all those things, they're going to be brought to account. So, nothing's going to get missed, right? In the reckoning. Nothing's going to get glossed over, right? You're not going to get the benefit of the doubt because there's not going to be any room for any doubt. All that you've done, together with the motives for doing them, will be on display. Everything you've done, whether openly, secretly, whatever you think, all that's going to be brought into the open and judged. Fourth, and this is, I think, very important, it will be a righteous judgment. For all of its verdicts will flow from a complete and infallible knowledge of all men's characters and actions. Acts 17:31.
Acts 17:31. Because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead.
Yeah, it's going to be a righteous judgment. You know, on earth, we're used to unrighteous judgments, right? We're used to the miscarriage of justice. Depending on where you live and the times in which you live, that miscarriage will be greater or lesser. But there's always some miscarriage. You know, human judges are full of themselves. Human judges are fallible. They won't always even allow all the evidence to be brought forward. But God has all that evidence. God's judgments are going to be completely righteous because his judgments are going to be exacting, right? He's going to judge, and it'll be an exacting judgment. I mean, he knows exactly where and to what degree you've sinned. He can very easily discern what was malicious and what was not. What was intentional and not intentional. And so all of these things make for a righteous judgment. There's not going to be any appeal. Right? Because it's righteous. There's also not going to be any appeal because in the fifth place, it's a final judgment from which there will be no appeal. This is it. You've been judged this or that You've been judged certain ways throughout your life. But this judgment is going to be complete and final, so that once the sentence is pronounced, it's going to be enacted. In Matthew 25:46.
Matthew 25:46. He shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal.
Yeah, there's not a pause. Right? There's no pause because there's no reason for an appeal. Not only is there no time, it's the last day. There's no reason. The judgment rendered, the sentence pronounced, will be completely righteous. It's not going to miss anything. Everything about your life is relevant. Remember that. Every thought, word, and deed is going to all come into judgment. It's all relevant. And none of it will be ignored. None of it is going to be excluded. All right, question five. What are the final causes or ends of this judgment? Why is this such an important thing? I think there are three reasons that we can trace out. There may be a lot of ends of this judgment, but I think three are very clearly held forth in Scripture. The first is, in this judgment day, there's going to be a display of both the justice and mercy of God. The former, in punishing the wicked, look at 2 Thessalonians 1:8-9.
2 Thessalonians 1:8-9. In flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God, and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power.
And the latter in rewarding those who are his friends, Matthew 25:34. Okay, so in this judgment, we're going to see both the righteousness and the mercy of God. We're going to see he's just and that he's merciful. All of that's going to be on display in this last judgment, this judgment day. In punishing the wicked, God will show us that he is, in fact, a just God. In pardoning the righteous, those who believe, those who are made righteous for Christ's sake, we're going to see that he's also a merciful God. Second, second end of the judgment is that there will be a manifestation of the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ, who, as mediator, remember, he came in obscurity in the form of a servant, but now he's come in power and great glory.
Titus 2:13.
Yeah, the blessed hope, the great glory. He's come in power and glory. Not the way he came the first time, as a humble servant, but as he is indeed the eternal Son of God incarnate. That's going to be on display. It's going to manifest his glory as he takes to himself what would otherwise be a matter of divine prerogative. That's his by donation. He's been rewarded with this as a result of his suffering and death. And third, I don't think this is of least importance in this, the rewarding of men according to their works, and thereby vindicating the providence of God from the imputation of unrighteousness in his governing of the world. Psalm 58:11.
Psalm 58:11, so that a man shall say, verily there is a reward for the righteous, verily he is a God that judges in the earth.
Yeah, why is he going to do this? So that men will say, verily there is a God who judges. Right? Men right now are just looking at the providence of God. They have a very different view. There, many men are inclined to impute some kind of unrighteousness to God and his governing of the world. You know, they whine about it. Why do good men suffer? Why do bad things happen to good people? Judgment Day is going to make it very clear that nobody's getting away with anything. So, things often seem to carry with an unequal balance in the present life, right? I mean, the wicked prosper as if they were rewarded for being evil. The godly suffer as if being punished for being good. But this disparity is because the men fail to meditate upon the end of all things. Psalm 73:2-20.
Psalm 73:2-20. But as for me, my feet were almost gone. My steps had well nigh slipped. For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride compasseth them about as a chain. Violence covereth them as if garments. Their eyes stand out with fatness. They have more than heart could wish. They are corrupt and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walketh through the earth. Therefore his people return hither, and waters of a full cup are wrung out to them. And they say, how doth God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world. They increase in riches. Verily, I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. If I say I will speak thus, behold, I should offend against the generation of thy children. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then understood I their end. Surely thou didst set them in slippery places. Thou castest them down into destruction. How are they brought into desolation as in a moment? They are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one waketh, so, O Lord, when thou awakest, thou shalt despise their image.
Right. So, the point is, men misread providence, but Judgment Day is going to set that straight. It's going to make clear that God didn't misgovern. He wasn't doing a sloppy job. He wasn't failing to pay attention. He's not the God of the deist who wound things up and walked away to see maybe to see what happened or didn't care to see what happened. Judgment Day is making clear God was not only aware, but he was already setting men in a position to receive what they've done in their bodies, whether good or ill. Right, so Judgment Day is the culmination of history, and it's also the point at which the exaltation of Christ is most on display. Because we're going to visibly see Christ, the mediator, executing judgments on the righteous and on the unrighteous, on believers and unbelievers. And he will, in all of that, exercise an authority that he's received because he suffered in the flesh. Now, next time, we're going to begin talking about the mediation of Christ and the fruits of his mediation. We come to the end of his humiliation and exaltation. And all of this is pointing us now to mediation. What can we know about his mediation? Why is this important? We'll begin looking at that next time, Lord willing.